أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدرك بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين على عبد المعيد الرسول المسدد المحمود الأحمد أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعن الله أعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها الذين آمنوا استجيبوا لله وللرسول إذا دعاكم لما يحييكم واعلموا أن الله يحول بين المرء وقلبي وأنه إليه تحشرون. صلوات على محمد وعلى آله. Battling today's Islamophobia is our topic. Tonight is lecture number 3. Yesterday, for those of you who were with me, we introduced the topic yesterday, talking a little bit about the current situation here in our country and across the world as it pertains to Islam and how Islam is viewed. We talked about why, of all the topics to talk about in this month of Ramadan, we chose this one, and how there is a link between what's happening right now in the world and our ibadat and worship. We talked about this idea that it is Iksala bihaji Muhammadu ala Muhammad. Sorry, sometimes it takes a few days for the body to get used to the fasting. My body's still getting used to it, sorry. As we said yesterday, the idea of worship now has to take a different toll. You know, I was talking to a few brothers last night here after the iftar, and there's a brother who made a very good point. It's a point that I've often heard from my teachers as well. I want to share with all of you. And that is that, you know, sometimes when we're younger, or maybe even now, if your mom was to say, you know, go and get me some water, or if you do this, I'll give you a candy, I'll give you a chocolate, I'll buy you, you know, an iPad nowadays. If you do this, this is what you'll get. And so we do it for that reason. We do it for that candy. We do it for that prize. We do it for that treat. And our parents use that as a good motivational technique to not only get the kid to do what they want, at the same time let them know that what you did was good. Now, for example, if I was 6 years old and my mom said, look, if you get me a glass of water, I'll give you this candy, and I would run and get the water, and she'd give me the candy, I'd be happy. If now she was to offer me a piece of candy for a glass of water, I'd say, look, mom, I don't want the candy, because it's no longer about the candy. It's about the fact that getting my mother a glass of water is the right thing to do. As we entered the realm of the ibadat when we were 15 or 9, and we're getting older and older at this age, or my elders, eventually you motivated yourself with either heaven or hell, that treat that Allah dangles in front of you being an akhirat of bliss. But eventually, it can't be about the candy. The worship is no longer about that treat that you might get at the end of your life. It's about the fact that worshiping Allah is the right thing to do. But the beauty of God's worship is such that if you have been doing it up until now for that treat, may Allah, inshallah, grant you that treat, and that's fine. That's why Amir al-Mu'mineen has a very nice classification you've heard several times of ibadat in Nahj al-Balagha. Right? The businessman, the slave, and the free man. The tujar, the abd, and the ahrar. He says there are individuals who worship Allah for three reasons: hope, fear, and love. The businessman has hope for heaven. Allah, I give you 30 days of fast in this heat, 16 hours, I want heaven in return. I'm selling my fasting, I want you to give me heaven in return. Or the abd says, Allah, I'm doing all this for you just to avoid the idea of me not going into hell. So you become a slave in front of your master. Then the ultimate level of worship is the one that doesn't worry about heaven or hell. You're worshiping Allah because He is worthy of that worship. He is layiq of that worship. No longer is it about the candy. No longer is it about the treat, the motivation, the dangling carrot. None of that. It is because it's the right thing to do. And so we have to move from that candy stage in our worship to now move towards it being part of your zat, your essence. And that only happens through these types of months. We have 30 days now as training ground. And this is the ultimate time for us to now develop that internal connection towards Allah and remove the idea that I'm doing this so I can get heaven. You'll get heaven, inshallah. You work for it, you'll get heaven. But is that what you want? Because the Ahlul Bayt work for something else. In that same Dua Al-Qamar, you read this Thursday, inshallah, Amir al-Mu'minin says, if you place me in the Hawfa, I'll still yell out to you, Ya Wali al-Mu'minin, or where are you, the friend of the believers? But yeah, maybe I didn't get the candy at the end, but I'm not going to lose that proximity towards me and you. I'm still going to call you my Wali. You're still going to be that connection that I need, even though I didn't attain that candy. It wasn't about the candy. It's about what is the right thing to do at that moment. And the faster all of us, myself included of course, understand this concept of worship, the faster we're going to be able to benefit from these types of months. We are in the peak and the awj and the highest level of the spiritual season of the Islamic calendar. Our calendar that we have, the secular one, from January to December, you know that the tax season has a certain amount of months. The school year has a certain amount of months. So from September to June is known as the school season. Similarly, within our Islamic calendar, we have certain seasons. And the spiritual season starts in Rajab and ends with the month of Ramadan. That's why in some mafatis, you'll find that Sheikh Abbas Qumi didn't start his amal with the month of Muharram. It's with Rajab. Because these were and are the 3 months right now for us to gain enough for us to be able to live the next 9 months. And if Allah grants us life for the next Rajab, inshallah, then we refresh ourselves. Does this topic of Islamophobia, connecting the time and the era and the affairs of today with worship, becomes a little bit tricky. And I want all of you to understand that moving forward. If you don't get this now, the lectures later on won't make sense to any of you. So let's not limit worship to a very confined amount of worship. Yes, there are defined Ma'aruf Shodeh worship inside of our books. Like the Tasbih and Salat and so on, those are all in front of us. But then there are other aspects of worship that can be very much worship if you attach the proper intention to it. And part of that is the awakening we're talking about in this day and age, to fight this phobia. Now, in today's lecture, we're going to look at the source of this phobia. Why are they so scared of us? Number one. What do we present to the table that brings about so much fear in the eyes of these who are Islamophobers, they're called? And tomorrow we'll look at this idea that is it safe or is it fair for us to blame all the outside forces for this phobia, or are we doing something to add to this phobia? Sometimes it's not just the outside forces. Sometimes we, and our extremism, and our decisions, and the way we live our life, the way we present Islam to others, we feed that phobia, we feed that extremism, we feed that terrorism that sometimes is labeled inside the media. So we have to be very, very careful about that. So understanding this phobia is to understand modern slavery. This part of the world wants to ensure that they dictate to all of us what to wear, how to think, what to eat, everything from the color of our clothes to our hairstyles to the latest phone that we should have. It's obviously a consumerized society. It's all about consumerism. They want to sell you everything that they have. But in doing so, they want to dictate to you how you should be. They want to do what's called mind control with all of you. They want to sit there and tell all of you that, look, if you don't do A, B, and C, you'll be an outcast in society. They can't understand why in this 35, 41 degree weather, our sisters want to cover themselves from head to toe. And so because they can't understand that, they call them imprisoned, they call them unfortunate, they call them oppressed, etc., etc. They don't understand that. And if anybody fights back from this Western style, then for them, you're a little bit off. So you're a judge in society. You're taught with the media, with commercials, with television shows, with everything, how to think, how to act, how to be, what to wear, like I said, all these things are there. This is today's modern slavery. They enslave your thoughts. They capture your thoughts. They want to dictate to you how to be. And those who show a little bit of pull against this concept are those individuals who they don't like, who are the enemy, who are individuals who are going to push back with this Western agenda. And sometimes a lot of our youth fall for this agenda, and sometimes they don't, alhamdulillah. There are people right now who live in the West, enjoying the freedoms of the West. At the same time, they're not enslaved by the Western thought. So in today's modern slavery, one of the tactics that they use to ensure that you are one of them is mind control, brainwashing. And you've heard this several times. It's an old tactic all the way back to the Ahlul Bayt's time. When Muawiyah is convincing his people to read Salatul Jummah on Wednesday, and no one's even questioning him, that's enslavement. It's brainwashing. Yes, it's fear, no doubt. At the same time, he's convinced them that, look, I am the Khalifa of the time. I can make Salatul Jummah, that's named the Friday prayers, to be on Wednesday. Allah comes to Amin al-Mu'mineen and says, look, don't be enslaved by him, be enslaved by Allah. Whatever Allah says. You're the slave, he's the master. And Muawiyah didn't like that. And like I said yesterday, he resorted to desperate tactics. Attacking the shaksiyat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen. No, you want to fight and you want to battle. You battle with logic and aql. Come sit down on the table. Let's discuss this logically. You bring your arguments, I'll bring mine. Udu'u ila sabili rabbika bil hikmati, the Quran says. With wisdom, call people towards the path of Allah. These people had no wisdom. So they resorted to barbaric actions. And today, when you see the ultimate last level of desperation, they resort to barbaric actions, setting boats on fire, bulldozing homes, worrying about other peoples and other countries and nations while your nation itself is drowning. It's all in the name of freedom. It's all in the name of the media. And these are things that we have to not to be scared to talk about. You know, this individual who shot 16 people during the Dark Knight filming in Colorado. I'm sure you've all heard about it. It's all over CNN for 4 days now. If you read his profile, he was a individual who every single year would be a big brother in a Jewish camp. That's how they described him. He was a man who was a brilliant mind, apparently, and he was involved in his community. He would attend these camps. Now, had this brother been a Muslim, and had that also been the same, that they come to camp every single year, and they're a big brother in a camp, it would have been a terrorist camp. It would have been an Islamic Muslim Al-Qaeda Taliban training camp. It's blatant nowadays. And for us to remain quiet today's day and age is not called for. This oppression is happening in their own backyard, and their national interests lie in different countries. You know, when we talk about this one government, we're not talking about conspiracy theories here, brothers. We're not talking about, you know, whatever you want to talk about. We're talking about this underground movement. No, we're talking about the fact that when a country on national television is saying that our national interests lie in Afghanistan, our national interests lie in Iraq, your national interests should lie in America. Why are your national interests lying in a different country, overseas, on that part of the world? It's becoming a very global movement, a very global government. And the one obstacle that's on the path of these individuals is Islam. And specifically, that of the Ahlul Bayt. Because they want to make sure that they enslave our minds, enslave our lives. And like I said, those who resist are those who are marked. Now, what's our role in all this? What do we do? Does that mean that we don't live a Western lifestyle? Does that mean that we don't buy into this consumerism? Of course not. Enjoy your dunya. This dunya is made for you. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamu alayha, describes... describes this dunya, and he actually praises the dunya. This is the place of mercy, he calls it. This is the place where the wahi of Allah came down. This is the place where angels descend on the night of Qadr. So yes, while we hear about the dunya being a disgusting place, and Mawla Ali gave talaq 3 times to it, that's one portion of the dunya. And our Holy Prophet says, al-dunya dunya nan. There are two dunyas. Dunya balighan wa dunya mal'una. What is this dunya mal'una? The cursed dunya. And that first one is the successful dunya. You can actually gain success from it. To understand this idea of the difference between those two dunyas, I want to tell us a small story. I often tell this story. I'll repeat it here because it fits. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. You find this story a lot in Irfanic books, and many of the ulama have shared this story. It's a beautiful story and one that you can gain many lessons from. There was a man who was a boy who was being chased by a lion in the forest. And he was running for his life, of course. Looking for some salvation somewhere. In the distance, he sees a well. A metal hook over it and a rope going into the well halfway down. He says, if I can get to that well and jump into the well and grab the rope, I'll be okay. The lion won't come down the well. He sprints and sprints and sprints and sprints and sprints, goes all the way inside the well, grabs onto the rope and begins to sway back and forth. He made it. The lion is perched on top of the well looking down. He says to himself, if I wait long enough, the lion will eventually get tired and go away after somebody else. He makes the one mistake that a lot of us shouldn't do in that condition. He does what? He looks down. He looks down, he sees the mouth of an alligator like this, open, ready for him. The lion is perched on top, the crocodile or alligator is at the bottom with his mouth wide open, and he's on the rope hanging on for dear life. Again, he thinks to himself that if I wait long enough, they'll both go away eventually. At that moment, he begins to hear the gnawing of the rope ever so slowly. He looks up, he sees a black mouse and a white mouse ever so slowly chewing on that rope. Lion on top, crocodile on the bottom. A black mouse, a white mouse eating at the rope, and he's holding on to that rope. If I asked you, what would you do if you were him, what would you tell me? If I asked you that we are all right now in that position, what would you tell me? Because the story goes on to say that the lion represents death chasing you. The alligator with his mouth open represents the grave waiting for you. The black mouse represents night. The white mouse represents day. Time, the rope is life, clutching on. The story goes on to say, in this state, in this halat, in this condition, he smells honey that's scraped against the wall of the well. And the honey is mixed up with dirt and mud, but it's fresh honey. If you've ever smelled fresh honey, it has a very khas smell to it and a beautiful taste to it. We don't get honey here. You go to the Middle East and Eastern countries, you get real honey there. It's sugar here. In the well now, after this whole situation I just painted for you, he decides to himself, you know what, I've been running all day from this line, I'm pretty hungry. He begins to sway himself towards the honey and begins to eat the honey with his fingers. You would think to himself, look, with all due respect, leave the honey alone for a while, get yourself out of this predicament, and then move on to the honey. Doesn't do that. The story goes on to say that honey represents this dunya mal'una. That makes us ghafil towards our real state. He forgot the lion, he forgot the crocodile, he forgot the mice, he forgot the rope, he forgot everything. His focus was on that dirt-infested honey because it attracted him. And this is this dunya that these individuals in this part of the world, in this society, want to create for all of you. They want to make your nafs your God, my youth especially. They now teach in schools that, look, you know, they teach a small kid 911, right? If your parents lay a hand on you, 911, child services. They teach you that no one can tell you what to do or not to do. If you want this, it's yours. Take it. You are your own person. Buy what you want, eat what you want, have what you want. Your nafs is your God. Islam says no. Your nafs is not your God. Because at that moment when your nafs is your God, literally the picture that's formed is that you're going up a mountain and the donkey is on your back and you're carrying the donkey up. Well, in actuality, the donkey was there to carry you up the mountain. That nafs is not made for it to be carried by you up the mountain. The nafs says, look, use me to get to prosperity. Because there are dimensions within the nafs that we don't reject. Islam doesn't reject shahwa and lust and desire. Doesn't reject anger and ghazab. Doesn't reject waham. All these things are not rejected by Islam. But we say they have to be controlled and tamed. And overpowered and controlled by that aql and logic and reasoning that makes us different from animals. That's why when Amir al-Mu'mineen says the state of the human being can be higher than angels or less than animals, that individual that sacrifices reasoning for his shahwa and ghadab is worse than animals. Animals don't have aql and logic. We do. We choose not to use that logic and follow our nafs on the path in this life. We're worse than animals. Or we choose that state where our nafs is controlled by our aql. We get angry, we first ask our aql. How do I react to that anger? I have desire, I have lust, I want this, I want this, I want that, I want to marry her, I want to marry him. Let's ask the aql. Does this fit the criteria of Islam? If it does, go ahead. This is an insan. This is what the Holy Prophet, all the prophets, all the imams came down for. Insaniyat. For you to be an individual who's controlled by your aql, who's governed by your aql. But this society wants something else from all of you. They don't want you to be logical human beings. They want you to be individuals who want something and go out and work for it. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. And if you speak out against that lifestyle, whatever lifestyle, you're someone who's abnormal. You're not natural. So understanding that Islam brings about this concept of the freedom from that enslavement of the West, and that's why they fear us. That if these people get a little bit of awakening, if these people have a little bit of sha'ud, a little bit of understanding, if they rise up and understand that society is dying right now, and they hold on to the rope of Allah, then they're going to conquer us. Like I said in the very first speech, we should be a nation that's dead by now. They destroyed our Ahlul Bayt. They poisoned them. They killed them. They imprisoned them. They ridiculed them. They embarrassed them. Then they move on to our ulama. They killed our ulama. They burned our books. They attack our families. They bulldoze our homes. And yet we are right now progressing forward as a nation of Shiism in the world. Because haq and truth will always prevail. It's a promise of Allah. Provided you're able to hold on to that. You don't get swayed easily. The example I use of Malik Ashtar was just that. He was a warrior. He was a commander in the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen. But he was an individual who was never shaken by the enemy. He wasn't one who was fooled in Siffin by Muawiyah's Quran tactics. No. He was staunch in his belief. And we need to be the exact same way. And so understanding this fear also understands that we are individuals who also understand enslavement. But we want to be enslaved by Allah. We want to be able to sit there and say, Allah, I am your abd. Because through that abdiyat, you will gain something. Our Holy Prophet gained risalat through his abdiyat. He was first an abd, then a rasul. Not a rasul, then an abd. Because of him being an abd, he was given risalat. وَشَهَدُنَا مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ وَتَشَهَدُ we recite. He was an abd first, and based on the level of abdiyat, he gained risalat. Amir al-Mu'mineen was an abd first, and then the imam of the time. And that requires a huge sacrifice on our end. Live in this society, enjoy its benefits, but don't under or overvalue the value of those things in this world. What do I mean by that? I'm saying, what's salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. So we have this confusion sometimes. Our youth, they oftentimes ask, that this balancing between the dunya and the akhirat, how do I do this? On one portion we hear that, you know, don't attach yourself to this world, but I want a nice car, a nice home, I want lots of money, I want to be comfortable. I want to be able to say to my family that money is no object. On the flip side, I don't want to sell my akhirat short out for this dunya. And in this confusion, we see extremes in our communities, and I'll talk about that tomorrow a little bit. Extremes where? Where a youth that has a little bit of tawfiq, he lives a life such that he's completely a hermit. Antisocial. Stays in his room all day with a dustbin in his hand. He thinks that's Islam. Doesn't smile, doesn't laugh, doesn't play, doesn't do anything. Doesn't interact. It's him and Allah, him and Allah, him and Allah. That's one extreme. The other extreme is what? That you're so assimilated in this society, you lose your name, you lose your identity. You change your name, you lose your hijab. That's one extreme. This balance has to be achieved. When Luqman is telling his son that if you sell out your akhirat for this dunya, you'll lose both. But if you sell this dunya out for the akhirat, you'll gain both. It means you live in this world. My experience has been that if you don't chase things in this world, money, fame, fortune, whatever, it chases you. If you don't want any of it, it comes and knocks on your door. Say, look, I'm here to present myself to you. From sources that we never even knew existed. مَنْ حَيْثُ لَا يَحْتَسِبْ, the Qur'an says. I will give you a risk, Allah says, from a source that you never even accounted for. Doors that we never even thought existed open up, we walk right through. How many times have we done that in our life? Stories, I'm sure, across the board here. You lost your job, you think, oh my God, that was the only company that I was hiring. Now all of a sudden, the phone rings. You never even thought about this field. And now, mashallah, you're doing well. مَنْ حَيْثُ لَا يَحْتَسِبْ. You never did a hisab of that source, but it's there. Don't attach yourself to these things. Don't give it more value than it is. That's why when Amir al-Mu'mineen constantly reminds his children and his companions, if you're going to sell the akhirat out for this dunya, make sure what you're selling out in this dunya is worth more than jannat and the akhirat. Because that's what you're giving up. Ask yourself, is it worth it? I'm in love with this individual, they're not Muslim. There's a chance I might get deviated off the path. Is it worth it? Are you not able to sacrifice a little bit of heartache, a little bit of heartbreak for the idea that of salvaging your deen? I don't have the latest, greatest of these kind of things. But we live in a very, you know, up with the Joneses era, right? Whatever he has, I want. Whatever they want, I want. A young couple goes to another couple's house for dinner, and all they look around is, oh, they have this painting and that furniture and this big screen TV and that and that and that. And the whole ride home, they're thinking to themselves, I wish we had all this. So they go out, they don't have the money for it, they charge everything, and they plaster their home with the exact same things that that person had, only to keep up. Now you're drowning in debt, you're not happy, but you're the Joneses, you're right up there. Is it worth it? Because now you've taken money out of the mouth of your child to make sure you have the latest and greatest television set in front of you. Don't give it more value than it is. Enjoy it, use it, earn it. You spent time in school, you worked hard, mashallah. You're a professional in your field, you're making good money, enjoy it. Islam doesn't say to wear patched up clothing and drive clunkers and live in a shack. No. We have prophets who were kings of their time. But fix a price on those things. My youth especially. Don't give up those things that are jannati for these things that are this world. As my teacher would always say, you know, don't sacrifice those things that are farishi for those things that are arshi. Don't sacrifice those things that are temporary for those things that are permanent. Well, doesn't that make sense? In the law of investment, in the rules of investment, and all of us, all of you guys who are doctors and lawyers and accountants and business individuals and successful individuals, there was a time where you were working day and night, not getting paid. You were up all night studying, and you knew that I wasn't going to get paid for this right away, but the investment was there. To my elders in the audience, how much have you invested for your children and sacrificed for your children? You work odd jobs just to feed your family. You left the comforts of your country to come here for your kids, for that investment. How much have we invested in our worship for the hereafter? And how much are we sacrificing for that hereafter? Because if you allow this society and this global movement to swallow you up, then you're going to be one of the khasirun in the hereafter. Those individuals were not successful, God forbid. So this is extremely important for us to understand in this topic as we move forward, that this fear that they have for us is just that. We are that source of freedom against their enslavement. And they can't stand it. They don't like it. Where Muawiyah preached enslavement of the minds, Amir al-Mu'mineen said, you be azad when it comes to your nafs. But that azadi is not the freedom that we have in this part of the world. I was reading just today online that one person defined freedom as the ability to open the door of the cage of the bird and allow him to go from nest to nest to nest to branch to branch to branch. That to them is freedom. That's not freedom in the eyes of Islam. It's chaos. One of the ways that we can prove the need of religion in Islam is the idea that man has to live by rules. We're governed by rules. For example, if you don't set a speed limit on the 401, what's going to happen? It'll be chaos. And so if you allow yourself to go all over the place, then at that moment it becomes very, very difficult. And the first step in this path of worship is the sahat of that worship. You have to know what Allah wants from you and how He wants it from you. You can't pick and choose how you want to worship Allah. For example, your professor says to you that, look, you have a 25-page paper due at the end of the semester. This is your topic. I want a table of contents. I want it page numbered. I want a double space. I want Times New Roman font size 12. I want a reference page. Those are my conditions. You go out and you write an amazing paper. You blow that professor away. But instead of 25 pages, it's 18 pages. Single space. Font size 10. No reference pages. He'll give you a mark that's less than perfect. You'll say, Professor, I worked very hard for this. Please. You're amazed by it. You're very happy by it. He says, yeah, you're right, but you didn't fit my conditions. I was very specific in saying I want this and this and this. You decided to give me a report that you wanted to give me. It's not kamil, it's not perfect. No doubt the content is great. But I need that sahat, I need that package, I need that beauty, I need what I ask from you. We've taken Islam as our own personal thing. That's why the ulama al-Qum say there are now two Islams in this world. One Islam is in our zihn, our mind. One Islam is reality. The Islam in our mind is something that we have created inside of our mind. And the Islam that is reality and outside in the world is something that's sometimes very far from us. That's why our youth get a little bit scared when they hear about this idea that when the Imam comes, he's going to bring a new deen to the world. What does that mean? Does that mean no Islam? No, of course not. It means that it's not going to fit the Islam and the deen in your zen, in your mind. It's going to be that Islam in Muhammadi. At that moment, if we read up the history of our Holy Prophet, we know one reality is for sure there. And that is that he existed at a time of utter ignorance. All of you know that. And I often say this whenever I go speak. If we can, we should read up a little bit more about our Holy Prophet's history. We know very little about what he went through. to bring about Islam to us. In that utter darkness, the beauty of our Holy Prophet was two things. Number one, he was that source of nur amongst the darkness. Number two, he wasn't affected by that darkness. He lived amongst the people. He lived with the people. But he was never once included as one of them in terms of his sinat. When that entire avenue, when that entire era, that entire atmosphere was filled with darkness, that one nur of our Holy Prophet came about. And like mosquitoes run towards the light, there were those who were young and poor that ran towards the Holy Prophet. And they say the exact same thing is going to happen when the Imam comes of our time. There'll be so much darkness in this world, he's going to bring once again that nur of Muhammadi, inshallah, and then, like mosquitoes, we will flock towards that light. It won't be an initial conquest where we think that we're going to have our swords and he's going to start chopping off heads. No. He's going to speak to the hearts of people. He's going to speak to those individuals who are hopeless, who are voiceless, and say, I'm your voice, I'm your hope. I am that nur. That's why in the Quran, where you have dhulimat, you have nur. Where you have nur, you have dhulimat. Dhulimat is plural in Arabic. Nur is single. One nur for many darknesses. It should be anwar and dhulimat, or dhulm and nur. But the Quran is very specific by saying that to answer any dhulimat, you need one nur, and that's it. And that nur is enough. We have that nur right now in Ghaybat. Our job while he's in Ghaybat in this month of Ramadan, in this worship, is to begin to create that nur inside of us. Before you can accept any revolution, you have to create the revolution inside of you. And you do that through a different way of looking at worship. A different way of enslaving yourself towards God. God doesn't need us, remember that. We need Allah, obviously. His kingdom will not be affected by our actions. Everything He's brought down to us is for our benefit and our benefit alone. So as we move forward, tomorrow's lecture, inshallah, we'll look at this idea that why do these extremes come about in our communities, amongst our youth especially sometimes, where sometimes we add and we give them reason to fear us. And that has to be addressed and has to be looked at, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept this qaleel ibadat, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that in this month of Allah's, you give us tawfiq to maximize the benefit from this month, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's so much oppression, injustice, and tyranny in the world. The only solution that we see is the coming of the wali of Allah. We ask you, Allah, hasten that reappearance and allow us the tawfiq and the pleasure of being alongside him in his mission, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.